Blog Talk Radio. This is Love's Outer Limits, and I'm your host, Dr. Amy Marsh, sexologist, hypnotist, lots of other kinds of things, and I'm with my co-host, M. Christian, otherwise known as Chris, erotica writer, sexuality writer, sexual futurist, and also lots of all kinds of other things. We've got a great show lined up for you today, so welcome. Hey, so, Chris, hi, how are you doing this morning?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Are we ready for this next show?
I think so. I'm all set.
Great. Okay. All right. Well, before we launch into our topic of objectum sexuality and an exciting new study that has come out in December 2019, I want to give a couple shout-outs, as I did last episode. The first is to tickle.life.com for their wonderful encouragement and support. They've created a podcast page for us. So if you go to www.tickle.life.com and go to the podcast menu, scroll down, and you will see Love's Outer Limits. And if I hear a keyboard tapping, don't do that. It's coming over the microphone. And then the other thing is, please go to support Disaster Arena's 2020 AIDS Life Cycle Ride from San Francisco to Los Angeles. That happens the end of May, first week of June, raising money for HIV/AIDS awareness, prevention, and treatment. And if you just type in Disaster Arena AIDS Life Cycle into YouTube, you'll come up with a great video and a link that will explain all about it. So that's my announcements for the day. Chris, do you want to add anything that you want to give a shout out?
Not really particularly anything, except that you can usually find my writing currently on kinkly.com and futureofsex.net, as well as a bunch of other places. And if you're curious about my work, you want to check out my website, which is pretty easy. It's www.mchristian.com. Beyond that, just happy to be here.
Yay, yes. And people can go to the show notes if they want links as well. So if you didn't happen to write all this stuff down, you'll be able to get there from here when you check the show notes. So, yeah. So, how do we want to launch into this? I've got so much to say.
Well, this is definitely something much more of your expertise. I just find it absolutely fascinating, and I'm looking very forward to hearing your thoughts on it. I know particularly you had some really fantastic news recently about the subject.
Well, yeah, and this is that new study that came out in 2019, pretty amazing, and I'll launch into the methodology and the findings of that study in just a little bit. You know, we probably have some listeners who want to know what objectum sexuality is, and I'm kind of wondering, Chris, when you first heard the term, what did you think it was?
Well, I've actually been familiar with it before. It's just the only thing I knew was just scatterings of little sensationalist news, like, you know, someone, you know, showed up in a news feed saying that they've fallen in love with everything from the Eiffel Tower to there's one person, I believe, who is emotionally connected to the overpass in San Francisco. But, you know, even at the time, I kind of felt it was a little cruel the way the media covered it. I mean, I've always kind of felt that desire and sexuality, unless it's, you know, non-consensual, is perfectly valid no matter what it is. I always kind of felt like the news was covering this kind of like, oh, look at the weirdo kind of thing, and that kind of always bugged me. But unfortunately, I never had an opportunity to really research it.
Yeah, the same thing bothered me too, actually, and that was really the impetus for the survey that I did in 2019, and it was supposed to be just a private survey for the OS International Group, which was a group of people who had found each other. They all identified as objectophiles or objectosexuals, and this was an informational website. It's still up, and there's also a link to that website on our show notes. But it's funny, I had a little precursor just the day before I heard about it for real. And a young, very young child in a family that I knew is autistic, and he sent a Valentine to my kids. And the front of the Valentine was a drawing of San Francisco's Sutro Tower, which is a radio tower. And it was surrounded by hearts. And I thought, oh, this is charming. And I remembered how one of my kids, when he was younger, used to make friends with Victorian houses in San Francisco on the way to nursery school. And in fact, we'd always have to pretend on the drive to the school that Onion Domi, which was one of the houses in the hills above the Haight, that Onion Domi had jumped into a trailer behind our car. Of course, we didn't have a trailer, but, you know, that didn't matter. And that Onion Domi, the Victorian, was coming to school with my kid. This was preschool days. So I was really aware of how children will experience personalities in objects all the time, you know, and this could be anything from stuffed toys to obviously Sutro Tower and Victorian homes. So that was the day before I got an email from a sexology colleague of mine saying, wow, you should watch this film. And this is a movie that has since been repudiated by the OS community. They felt it was too distorted and sensationalized, but it was still fascinating. And so that led me to the OS International website, and things kind of went off from there. Any comments you want to make about that before I continue?
Well, I'm curious about the film you referred to. I know there one that had existed, and it wasn't, like you mentioned before, really a very fair depiction or examination of the phenomenon. Which one was that one?
Oh, I mean, I'm trying to think of the title. It's on the OS International website, you know, saying that they repudiate it. There've actually been a lot of sort of television coverage. There've been two or three different movies done. The most recent I saw was called Animism, and I happened to catch that on Netflix, and it was all about objectum sexuality, actually. And at that point, they were making the case that the perception of personalities and objects was tied to an animist belief. And I'm not saying it isn't, because the animist belief is very deeply held among many of the people who do have object relationships. But the first one, I think, was, you know, there's this kind of smarminess about a lot of the coverage. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know exactly. I mean, for the longest time, you know, anything that wasn't, you know, heteronormative got dismissed as this kind of like my taboo love, or, you know, something showing up on, you know, on some kind of like weird late night channel or something somewhere. I'm glad they're starting to move beyond that, but it still shows up way too often.
I agree. I was fascinated, though, as I said, when I saw this film, and I got in touch via email with Erica Eiffel, who had been one of the people to set up the website and was certainly, I believe, had written a lot of the content and was operating at that point as kind of the public face of objectum sexuality. There were other people that had been known, but Erica seemed to have stepped in as a very eloquent spokesperson for objectum sexuality, and certainly put herself on the line, because every time there was a program that featured her, or some of the other folks, there was a barrage of, you know, vitriol coming from people hurled at the objectum sexuals. And when I began to trace some of the other media coverage, I felt that they were really missing some of the most interesting parts of the story, which to my mind was, how do you, number one, how do you perceive a personality in an object that makes you fall in love mm-hmm. with it and feel desire? And also, how do you navigate the world as that kind of sexual minority, which is held up to immense ridicule? You know, it's a sort of the carnival mm-hmm. of, you know, the freak show, sideshow, sexual sideshow tent in the circus of sexuality. And that upset me because I felt that there was a lot more to this, and certainly that I wanted these folks to have the respect that other sexual minorities are getting, at least in some places. You know, things are not completely great for everybody, but there have been some, some strides made, I'd say, in the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. So I had this email discussion and then later some phone conversations with Erica Eiffel. And there was just a point where off the top of my head, I said, you know, I think you guys need more data to give to the media and also to any researchers or to health professionals that, you know, anybody might be seeing. You know, I think you need more information about yourselves as a group that you can present. And at the time, I didn't think of this as anything other than a very private, kind of quick and dirty, simple survey. And it ended up being about 21 members, English-speaking members of OS International. Apparently, a few people wanted to take the survey so much that they sat down with dictionaries and tried to translate and answer as they went along, which I thought was very touching.
Very cool.
Yeah, it was. And I know that work was appreciated. It's acknowledged on the OS International website, or at least was last time I looked. And what I didn't expect was that the next time Erica was asked on a television program, and it happened to be Good Morning America in April 2009, that they had said to her, well, do you know anybody who's an expert on this topic? And Erica said something to the effect of, oh, well, this woman's just doing this survey research. And I landed on Good Morning America to talk about these results of this survey, which was not a scientifically done survey. It wasn't a carefully crafted study like the one that I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, the 2019 study. But the value of it is that it's a tone of respect, respectful sexological inquiry. And it also it got a lot of open-ended responses. So I have lots of statements from the OS people themselves about what they feel, what they think, who they are in relationship with, how they perceive gender, how they navigate other people sharing an object, for example, if they're in love with a building or mode of transportation that's a fairly public object. So there were lots of things that I was interested in from a sexological and also from sort of a clinical standpoint. Like, what do I need to know as a clinician if a person who is in relationship with an object comes into my office and needs assistance with something? You know, I mean, how do I educate myself to do a decent job on their behalf? So that was kind of the premise of that.
And I know your study, like, there's so many things I want to bring up. I know your study just recently got cited, as you mentioned, which is really exciting.
Well, yeah. Again, in this 2019 article, they do mention my survey in the paragraph. And they also note that the survey did not provide a baseline and some other things that would have allowed it to be a more I don't know, scientifically credible study. I mean, so, it wasn't really a study at that point, though. In the media conversations, even when I tried to sort of downplay and say, look, this was just a small survey, but these findings are interesting and should be followed up by better research. The media likes to inflate things or doesn't always listen well and sometimes doesn't get things right. So, there's been a little bit of a struggle with that. But yeah, they cited me in the first paragraph after the abstract. And
cool.
And yet they're perfectly correct in saying that they are the first study now that has done, how do they put it? It's the first study that really takes, I'm searching for a word here. So I'm having those moments where I can't. Let's see. They say this is the first study that, okay, well, before I get into that, anyway, it's the first really good study. Let me say that. Mine was just kind of a precursor with probably more value in the, I'm really grasping for the noun. There's qualitative information rather than a good quantitative delivery of information. So the qualitative comments, almost more like a sociocultural anthropological type of thing, rather than really being good with the numbers and being able to extrapolate in that way. So, I just have to be honest about the flaws of that first thing. But I did end up on Tyra Banks after that. I ended up on Natural Geographic Taboo after that. And in 2019, ended up in the first part of 2019, ended up on Australia's Channel 7 Sunday night show. And I wish I had known the study was going on or that the research had been published then, because it would have been fantastic to be able to say, and this recent study has been done, which shows X, Y, and Z. So that's kind of my weird history with all that.
Well, unfortunately, I know that you told me that, while you got some positive responses from your appearances, you also got a lot of blowback, or not blowback, but a lot of bigoted comments as well, which is unfortunate.
Oh God. Yeah. I was not prepared after Good Morning America for the onslaught of weirdness that came in my direction. I think Erica was a little more sophisticated, frankly, because it wasn't the first time she'd, been on media and had coverage, but I was appalled. Right-wing blogs were tearing me to shreds, ridiculing Erica, ridiculing Objectum Sexuals, ridiculing me. I think my favorite was I got called a whack job of a sexologist. And actually, I kind of like that now. It's sort of a, I don't know, I have a certain fondness for being a whack job of a sexologist, I guess, now that some time has gone by. But it was shocking. And also the weird Fox News shows, Laura Ingraham, we turned her down. I ended up on a live radio show out of Philadelphia, which I didn't know was going to be broadcast. A host verbally slammed me up against a wall about the filth that Good Morning America was letting into American homes. And I was saying, well, aren't you letting this filth into American homes this evening through the radio, Anyway, he was an idiot. He had no interest in talking to me about what I'd found out or what I thought I'd discovered. He just wanted to, eviscerate somebody, and that was me. So there was one point where I finally said, you sound like this is bothering you. Would you like to talk about it? And he hung up on me. So that was fun.
What's the old quote is, thou protest too much.
Yes, for all I know, he was fondling his microphone even as we spoke, you know, even as we spoke. But, you know, really, it was ridiculous.
And that's always kind of the trade-off. I mean, you know, it's like exposure is good because people now who, you know, are experiencing objective sexuality or any form of sexuality might feel they're alone and isolated. And to hear, you know, that people are recognizing it and there's others out there is very important. But at the same time, you also open up, especially on mainstream media, to like the sensationalistic, you know, how can we do the weird piece of the day thing. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. You know, it's interesting, by the way, I don't want to necessarily do a complete shout-out, but one thing that did cross my my feed the other day was an article on dangerous ideas called Ancient Animalistic Beliefs Live On in Our Intimacy with Tech. So it's interesting that people are actually still talking about this kind of, you know, and, you know, as we talked about last time on our on your wonderful show about sex robots and such, it is kind of an animalistic kind of thing. But, you know, it's interesting because we've had a conversation there and I about how sometimes it can be almost cultural.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just want to say, did you mean to say animistic rather than animalistic?
Animistic, you're correct.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure. I thought so, but I wanted to make the correction for our listeners just so they knew, really. You can say animalistic all you want, though. That's okay for, you know, with me, but I just want the listeners to know.
It's definitely animistic. I misread it. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that you bring up that something crossed your feed. I came across something just a couple days ago. I was listening to a podcast on witchcraft, and an author of a book who was being interviewed talked about how, as a little girl, she has always perceived personalities and objects. And I was like, yeah. Now, she wasn't an objectum sexual, but an animist belief was something that pervaded her spiritual practices and her worldview, really, from a very early age. So I think it's around a lot, but not everybody. Those who might perceive personalities and objects and those who have an animist set of beliefs may not always go to the extent of becoming wildly attracted to an object. So, you know, there's gradations, I think, of the, you know, how this kind of perception plays out. But I think what I want to do really is talk about this incredible research that's done. And the reason I loved it so much, well, there's a few reasons. Number one, it's good science, and it was published in Nature.com scientific report. So that means it was very well reviewed. It was scrutinized, you know, good peer review in this. So that's fantastic right there that this topic has been given that kind of scrutiny by the scientific community, and that it made it into, you know, that part of nature.com. I'm getting a little hoarse here. So the study is called Objectum Sexuality, a Sexual Orientation Linked with Autism and Synesthesia. And it was, the three researchers are Julia Simner, S-I-M-N-E-R, James E.A. Hughes, and Noam Segev. And I just want to read their little opening, kind of their abstract here for a minute. It's not that long, but I think it states very well what the study was all about. So it says, objectum sexuality is an sexual orientation which has received little attention in the academic literature. Individuals who identify as OS experience emotional, romantic, and/or sexual feelings towards inanimate objects, e.g. a bridge, a statue. We tested 34 OS individuals and 88 controls and provide the first empirical evidence. That's the word I was searching for, empirical evidence, that OS is linked to two separate neurodevelopmental traits, autism and synesthesia. We show that OS individuals possess significantly higher rates of diagnosed autism and significantly stronger autistic traits compared to controls, as well as a significantly higher prevalence of synesthesia and significant synesthesia traits inherent in the nature of their attractions. Our results suggest that OS may encapsulate autism and synesthesia within its phenomenology. Our data speak to debates concerning the biological underpinnings of sexuality, to models of autism and synesthesia, and to psychological and philosophical models of romantic love. And I think one of the things that I adore about that paragraph is that they are acknowledging, you know, what as a sexologist we call sort of the biopsychosocial approach to sexology. And so they're taking a lot into consideration here. It's not just, data. It's not just data. They are providing a context for this data in the way that they've written up this research that I really like very much. So I'm going to back up just a second and say the reason that I was so struck by Objectum Sexuality when I watched that first movie is that during my student time, studying sexology, I had done a project, an investigation into autism, Asperger's syndrome, and sexuality concerns. And when I looked on the OS International website, they happened to mention that a number of their members had been diagnosed with autism, Asperger's syndrome, mm-hmm. or felt they had significant autism traits. But this wasn't everybody in the group, but that there was a significant number. So that's what grabbed my attention. Like, oh, is this something else I should know about in the spectrum of, concerns or issues that may be something that a person on the autism spectrum may encounter or experience? And so that was what grabbed me. And then it became very clear in the conversations that I had with OS people in private email or, you know, certainly through the survey and the qualitative data, the comments that people were making and the open-ended responses, that there was a lot which seemed to indicate a tie, at least with some people, with some traits on the autism spectrum, as well as indications of some forms of synesthesia. And I'm going to get to synesthesia in a minute, but this became very fascinating to me and was one of the things that fueled my interest. So I think I better take a break and let you get an edge, you know, word or two in here.
Well, no problem whatsoever, because I'm finding this absolutely fascinating. I know our listeners are too. I think it's a really interesting thing to consider. I mean, there's like I mentioned before, you know, kind of casually, you know, cultural things. I mean, I'm not an expert. I'm sure probably someone listening to this is going to be yelling at me, but, you know, in Shinto religion in Japan, you know, objects have souls. They have, you know, personalities. And there's also a mythological creature called a yokai, which is if an object exists for more than, I think it's like 100 years, it becomes actually animate. And I think that's kind of interesting. But, you know, it's sort of like jumping around a little bit here. The sex experimenter, I guess you could call her, Catherine Smooth, Smoos, and her mm-hmm. Her partner have been experimenting with some things, and they recently did a project that sort of almost could be argued created an artificial object of sexuality, in that she used guided imagery, hypnosis, even virtual reality to tie her sexual response cycle to the ocean.
Interesting.
And I'd be very curious to see, like, if this is like, I mean, did she actually achieve the same kind of objective sexuality that other people who experience it naturally occurred, or is this just sort of touching on the edge of it? Because I thought it was interesting, it's very much like objective sexuality. She removed, you know, a physical depiction of another person and replaced it with something that is arguably not alive. So I think that was kind of a really fascinating different kind of, you know, direction to that. And as we talked about before, I mean, you know, we might even be getting to a point now where we're also sort of doing the same kind of kind of thing to like our sex toys and that kind of thing. I mean, it even could be argued that people become aroused by certain kinds of media that's not directly sexual, but there's a whole world to explore. That's why I think this is absolutely fascinating.
Well, you're right. There is a whole world to explore. I mean, human beings as a collective group can pretty much eroticize anything and everything. I mean, that's just clear from my studies in sexology. This isn't true for all people, but in the collective group of human beings, pretty much anything can be eroticized and trigger desire. I think what you're talking about with the woman who tied her responses to the ocean, that almost seems to fall more into the eco-sexology realm,
mm-hmm.
where people like Annie Sprinkle and her partner Beth Stevens, have really been promoting eco-sexology, and they've actually gone around the world and married different landscape features, for example, including the ocean. And so they claim to have sexual responses to natural objects and features of the earth, and really probably to the earth itself. And that's a whole other topic we should definitely do on this show at some point. It would be another great fun thing to talk about. With regard to the findings of this study, I'm going to get into that a little bit because I think it might clarify things. So they had to take, these researchers had three different things that they were looking at. They were looking at people who are objectum sexuals. So they have object partners that are beloved. These aren't just sex toys that are used and play a part in the sexual response cycle. These are imbued with some kind of personality, and the relationships run the gamut of emotions. Very complex, just as they would be with a person. So they're studying the OS. They're looking at autism, and they're looking at synesthesia. And it is known that there are more incidents of synesthesia among people on the autism spectrum. So that had already been established several years ago. But they want to find out if there's a link between these three things. So the way they did about it is they had a series of studies. Now, this was all online. As I mentioned before, it was 34 OS individuals and then 88 controls. And the OS folks were recruited from online forums. And the people who were controls were drawn from an advertisement, responses to an advertisement at the University of Sussex, and they could participate in the study for course credit. But there was absolutely no mention in the advertisement of either synesthesia or autism because, they didn't want to skew results. They wanted a good control group. So then once they had the people collected, the OS individuals who were self-identified and from these online groups and the 88 control people, they gave them a battery of tests. And one was the autism spectrum quotient, or AQ, which was developed, quite a long time ago by Simon Baron Cohen, I believe. It's established in the literature. So they used that on both the OS people and the controls, And if somebody, if somebody in the controls tested fairly high on the spectrum, autism spectrum quotient, that was noted, of course. There were synesthesia protocols that were tested. They developed an in-house Sussex objectum sexuality questionnaire, which frankly I would love to see. It's not detailed in the study. and then using a 5-point Likert scale, they surveyed they asked people to use personality adjectives, and there are about 44 of them, to describe either their partners, if they were OS, or for those who didn't show up as on the Sussex Objective Sexuality Questionnaire, you know, is having any kind of link to OS, you know, a favorite object, you know, something that you like, your computer, your TV, your car, whatever. And they also did a multisensory test for graphene personification synesthesia. And plus they also grapheme color synesthesia. So they went at this in a very complicated and really interesting way to figure out, you know, where people were. Now, unfortunately, they said in the course of the article that at one point, seven of the OS group dropped out before the grapheme personification test, which is a shame, and that eight, which is probably the seven plus one, had dropped out of the grapheme color synesthesia test. So I think it's eight people total in the OS group did not do the synesthesia test, which is, you know, a shame, because they, so they took the conservative approach and decided that those people had dropped out who were all negative. And even with that, they found almost 40% of the OS participants tested positive or have been diagnosed for some part of the autism spectrum. And that there was also, even with that conservative thing of saying all the, you know, all the people who dropped out of the OS group before the synesthesia grapheme test, they still, there was a higher percentage of synesthesia detected in the OS group. I think the autism, oh, I think I said that almost 40% already. So it's pretty amazing. They designed this well. It had a lot of moving parts. But one of the things that was really important in the synesthesia test, consistency over time. So, for example, the woman who did the ocean research and tied her sexual responses to the ocean probably would not, I'm just saying, let's assume she doesn't experience any form of synesthesia at all. But in order to find out, excuse me, she would have to be tested for the same, did she experience personality characteristics in her interactions with the ocean? And if so, are these consistent over time? So what they did is they didn't just test once, they tested twice. They had a surprise duplication of the synesthesia test to see if there was consistency. So that was super, super important. So if someone said that their either favorite object or their object partner was even-tempered and affectionate the first time, they would be looking for that same description, the same, you know, out of the 44 personality adjectives, they were looking for a very consistent match the second time around. And they also used something called a power analysis to make sure that if they had 20 OS people, that would have been their minimum, and 50 controls, that would have been enough to give decent results to the study. So, you know, they ended up with 34, and some of them dropped out, but they still had, you know, over 20 OS people by the end of the study so that they could come up with, you know, come up with accurate results. They're, excuse me, more coughing.
Oh.
The last line in their, or almost the last line in their study, was really kind of remarkable because it said they, okay, so I'm going to read actually the last paragraph because it's good. It says, our study is the first behavioral treatment of OS in the scientific literature. Although inquiry into OS has gained little traction in modern science, wider understanding would be particularly beneficial given that objective sexuals are often marginalized for their orientation. In summary, we have shown links between OS, synesthesia, and autism, and propose that increased anthropomorphizing in OS may sometimes occur as a result of differences in social cognition and other autism-driven traits, as well as object personification synesthesia. Oh, actually, the sentence I wanted is in the paragraph above that. It said, our findings suggest, crucially, that personification, rather than personhood, may be the necessary prerequisite for romantic love to arise. And I thought that was a pretty stunning thing to include in this write-up. And yes, I was, you know, as I mentioned before, cited a couple of times in this article. I'm number 7 in their references for my article, which was called Love Among the Objectum Sexuals. And it was published in the 13th issue, 2010, of the Electronic Journal of Human Sexuality. So that can be found online as well. So that's, you know, that's kind of the upshot of all this. What I'm wondering about myself is, can this study be used to inform clinical practitioners, you know, sexologists, sexuality counselors, sex therapists, and other therapists, to have them really understand now what it is that where objectum sexuality may be encapsulated is a good word that they used earlier, but, you know, to understand the linkages, and so that there's less chance of ascribing this to trauma, sexual trauma, or not being socially well adjusted. And that was one of the things that disturbed me in earlier accounts, when they would get other kinds of experts to weigh in on objectum sexuality. So many of them went to the, oh, well, these people must have been sexually traumatized. And that wasn't the case. And then the other thing they would go to was, oh, well, they just must be mentally ill, which also is not always the case. Mm-hmm. In fact, hardly the case at all, because none of my respondents, I would say the majority of my respondents in my survey, did not report anything except that one person had Tourette's, one person had PTSD. A few people had experienced some kind of traumatic abuse, but it was not a high number. It was kind of no more than you'd find in any other grouping of 21 individuals, pretty much. And so what used to upset me is that these experts would weigh in, but they had assumptions. They had no data. They hadn't actually talked to any OS individual. So they really just sort of flippantly tossed off comments, which then became part of the, you know, sort of narrative around OS, but without any data to support that. So, yeah, that's my say, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, that actually, unfortunately, is something that seems to be fairly common among other sexual interests and desire patterns, for lack of a better word, is that, you know, there are some who I think rightfully so say, once again, as long as it's not harming anybody, it's perfectly valid and there's nothing wrong with it. And then there's always some, unfortunately, vocal minority that says, oh, this is a symptom of either societal collapse, mental illness, or aberrant behavior. And it's just like, and there's, once again, there's no evidence of it. And I'm sure if you probably did a survey of anybody's, you know, a slice of any sexual arousal behavior, you're going to find people who have suffered abuse or trauma and something similar. It's just the national average. So, you know, it's like it really comes down to almost being like it's basically kind of a form of intolerance is what it is. I mean, it's just like they just want to label again. It's like that kind of myth of normal again. It's like there is no such thing as normal. But, you know, one thing you touched on that I think was really interesting, and I now realize that my comment about, like, Catherine Smooth, not to discount what her project has done and what other things she's done, but you're right. It's like the one component that's missing is personality. Mm-hmm. So, you know, linking your sexuality to a non-physical representation of the human body is one thing, but there's no personality. I mean, over time, you might develop it, but it's not inherent in the attraction. It's almost like it has to develop as like almost like a relationship does. And I'd be curious to hear about how Annie Sprinkle's ecosexuality kind of does the same thing. Is this, you know, a experiment that leads to personification, or is the personification there and it draws, you know, attention to it? Again, it's interesting to see how, you know, other forms, and this is sort of tangential, and I'm not really trying to shoehorn in here, but with that sex cells again, many people who are found attracted to them develop personalities for them. They have their inherent personalities they experience while in their presence. But again, it's a human form. And I'm really curious about the synesthesia aspect too, because I mean, I heard somewhere that, you know, the majority of people sort of like have moments of it. Sometimes it's inherent, you know, and sometimes it's developed, like, you know, the same way that's like if you're in the presence of something, you start to develop like, you know, sort of like couples to taste and feeling. And I don't know, I mean, I think sometimes I have a touch of it because, you know, when I'm reading a book or something, I, of course, get visual images, but they're always very unique to that book or that, you know, particular object. But, yeah, I mean, I think this is absolutely fascinating. I think it's one of those things that's like, it's disappointing that so many people just kind of put it off on, as you commented, you know, the taboo sex or the my weird addiction, you know stigma. And it's just like, you know, I really despise that. I mean, I despise it pretty much just as much as I despise people who obviously want to turn it right around and say that it's a sign of, you know, illness or it's a sign of, you know, something else. It's like, no, it's like human sexuality has always been a wide field of everything in the planet. It's just now we're starting to recognize it more. I mean, we're actually starting to realize how what the percentage is and how people have these real attractions. And again, as long as you're not harming anybody, it's like, what's wrong with it? I don't understand this judgment.
I don't understand it either. And, you know, just sparking off of a couple of things that you just said, when you first told me about Catherine Smoos, right, I felt like that was more of a kind of a ritualistic, it almost felt ritualistic to me. It almost felt witchy, you know, in a way. That may not have been her intention, but I felt like that was a way to engage with something and to forge a connection between her and her sexual responses in the ocean, but not necessarily with a personification or, you know, as part of that, because you didn't, you know, I haven't actually looked at her website or tried to look her up, so I don't know. With Annie Sprinkle and Bess Stevens, it would be really fun to be able to ask that question about their relationships with different parts of the earth and natural objects. And then with, there was something that I wanted to mention. Oh, yeah. So one of the interesting things about being on Tyra Banks with Erica Eiffel, Erica was the person on the stage being interviewed by Tyra, and I was the expert in the audience that, you know, Tyra would turn to and say, well, we have in the audience Dr. Amy Marsh, sexologist. What do you think about all this? And I issue a couple sound bites, and Tyra says, fine, got it, and turns back to Erica. So, you know, it's that kind of format. I actually didn't know who Tyra Banks was before I got invited on the show because I didn't own the TV. So I had no idea. But anyway, the interesting thing to me is that when you could see this, you can see it on the Tyra at Night episode of 2009. I think it took place in October. She begins by almost kind of working the audience up to a state of, oh, we're going to have something really kind of weird and strange and kind of funny and nonsensical on the show. But by the time Erica said her piece, spoke very sincerely and very eloquently about what she experienced, and she had a model with her of the Berlin Wall, who was one of her beloveds, Tyra like did a complete 360 practically and was almost doing an Oprah approach, like, well, if you know anybody in your family who's dealing with this kind of thing, you know, there's more information about it out there. And it was very interesting to see that. And I saw the same thing happen at the Institute for Advanced Study of Human Sexuality during one of our 8-day SAR programs, which happened over the summer. And I was one of the people staffing this that year. Again, this was 2009, and I invited Erica to come and talk about objectum sexuality. Now, we had a whole room full of people who were therapists, medical people, sexology students, you know, a very, I would say these folks were a hard sell for what Erica mm-hmm. was going to bring. But again, she spoke. She was very articulate. She was very sincere. She was very precise. And she basically won over the entire room of people going, wow, yeah, gosh, I would have never thought it, but this is a thing. Yeah. And I have somewhere I have the CD that, you know, the tape of not the CD, the DVD of that session during the sexual attitude restructuring program. It was remarkable to me. And so, you know, it's one of the reasons that I was just so glad that Erica was one of the people out there talking about this in public, you know, going through all the horrible comments that she was getting and somehow rising above all of this to be able to bring the message that, yes, this is real. Yes, we deserve respect. Our partners deserve respect. And one of the things I think clinicians need to recognize is that no matter who you're in relationship with, no matter who your partner or partners are, when you lose them, you grieve. Your grief is real. When you have complicated things that bring up anger, resentment, feelings of abandonment, these are real, no matter who your partner or partners are. You can experience joy. You can experience excitement. You can experience reciprocity. All of these things are very real. And so it's important for us to go, oh, this is the person. These are their emotions. And not form judgments about the partners. Now, of course, I'm talking about adult consensual things. I'm not talking about things that are not adult and consensual. So, you know, just have to, you know, say that so people know. Basically, that's where you, and the only reason I leave out work with adolescents is that I'm not trained in that. You know, somebody else can, you know, other people are specialists in working with adolescents and educating adolescents about sexuality. That's not my expertise. And so that's why my arena is adult and consensual stuff. But within that, objective sexuality falls quite easily. So does ecosexuality. So do a lot of other things, mm-hmm. spectrum sexuality. It's all there, and I think it's all valid.
And I completely agree with you. I think that's why I think representation matters. I think it's one of those things where, you know, like you mentioned before, it's like, you know, Erica did, you know, was very brave appearing on the show, especially because there was the initial, you know, look at the weirdo kind of thing. But, you know, it's important that people get a voice and that people are seen and not just, you know, being able to be lumped together. I think representation, you know, once again, is extremely important because it's hard to dismiss someone if you can see them, if you can hear their words, if you can understand their viewpoint. That's why that's, you know, visibility, you know, getting out there is so critical. And I have tremendous respect for people who, you know, step, you know, into the limelight to be able to do this because, one, it takes tremendous bravery, but two, it's also you're standing up there for not just yourself, but for others out there with the same interests. And that's really kind of a noble pursuit.
Yes, yes. And I think it's very important in this instance, particularly because knowing that there are a number of people on the autism spectrum among the objective sexuality community. And again, it's not all objectum sexual people, not all of them are on the autism spectrum, but a fairly large, significant number. These are people who, let me put it this way, I was not sophisticated about the media and how to deal with it, and especially not the responses, the negative responses that came at me. I believe that reporters and people who write about this or who have invite OS people on their show as guests need to understand that there may or may not be a level of sophistication about the media and what happens when you get coverage, mm-hmm. and that they need to be informative. They need to disclose. They need to let people know that there's a chance that they may come across things said about them that are potentially devastating, and just take extra care because, you know, one of the things I've heard it said, for example, about people with what used to be called Asperger's syndrome is that they will take language very literally. Mm-hmm. They will believe people are telling the truth. And it's kind of incredible when they hear something that may be a lie or when something has been misrepresented or distorted. And I have the feeling that one of the reasons, though this is my speculation here, that one of the reasons that that one movie was repudiated by the OS community, it may have been that there was some behind the scenes misrepresentation or lack of disclosure about certain things that ended up being damaging for the people who appeared in that documentary. Mm. And so one of the things I liked about the Australia Channel 7 coverage, they interviewed three different people in three different parts of the world. And then I was there as the, you know, expert to comment on stuff. They were very respectful, and they were particularly respectful of one guest who was featured because they knew that he was emotionally very fragile at that point. And I just love the fact that care was taken. But you know what? I realize we are quickly coming to the end of our hour here. And so I'm looking at the clock ticking down. I think I should be quiet now. Chris, you have some last words for our next show?
What is our next show? I mean, I have the information here. One second. But I'm sure you probably know why off the top of the hat.
Right.
I think it's BDSM, right?
Yep. Emotional and physical safety. That's a program where I think you're going to be doing more talking than I am, and that's cool.
Oh,
so,
believe me, it's definitely not a competition, and absolutely delightful. And I'm sure our listeners agree. I mean, this is a fascinating subject, and one I think we actually should come back to because there's so much more to discuss. And it's been absolutely delightful. I mean, talking to you anyway and being on the show is a delight, but this subject particularly I think is absolutely fascinating. But yes, next time, which is going to be March 7th, is BDSM Emotional and Physical Safety. And that's
really
going to be
important.
A lot of fun. So we'll definitely talk about that one because there's so many myths around BDSM and so many things that people get into that really they should be warned about. And there's all kinds of things to keep in mind to do it safely, both emotionally as well as physically.
That's so important, Chris, and I'm just really happy that we're going to be doing that show next week. So to all our listeners, do tune in. Listen to our past archived episodes. We're going to be doing so much more of this, the outer limits of all kinds of things having to do with sexuality and relationships. So I think I'll say bye, and I'll put a little bit of music on before the show ends here. So, Chris, thank you so much. I love doing this program with you. I really do. And
anytime. It's absolutely a delight, and I can't wait for next time.
Yeah, same here. All right, well, we'll be talking. Take care, and everybody else, you take care too. Be safe. Be happy. Bye-bye.